Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The first thing we need is for our ocean ministers from the 56 countries in the Commonwealth to agree what should go into that declaration, because the declaration will be the expression of their hopes, their aspirations, and indeed their commitment to action.
Government ministers and officials gather for the first Commonwealth Ocean Ministers Conference in Cyprus.
When they're done with the threats, they'll come back to the table and talk, and they love to do what we want. So instead of going through it round and round and making patients suffer, they better come early, we talk, because as a union, we're not going to back down. But whatever we're asking for are reasonable things. Most of them don't even involve monetary issues.
Striking Kenyan doctors receive dismissal letters.
We have confidence in ECOWAS judges because they have already condemned the Togolese state for older issues. For example, they've condemned them and asked them to release political prisoners.
And a Togolese opposition leader is calling for a majority win in parliament to overturn the country's new constitution. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Cyprus, government ministers and officials gathered for the first Commonwealth Ocean Ministers Conference under the theme, A Resilient Common Ocean from Cyprus to Samoa. It follows a call by Commonwealth leaders at their heads of government meeting or CHOGUM in Rwanda in 2022 to develop a declaration to consolidate action on the conservation and sustainable use of the ocean, seas and marine resources. The conference, officials say, provided a forum to establish the principles, priorities and actions for a Commonwealth Ocean Declaration and to agree upon a roadmap for the adoption of a declaration at CHOGUM 2024 in Samoa. For more on the significance and steps needed for the adoption of the declaration at CHOGUM 2024, I reach Patricia Scotland. She is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations.
The most important thing is for us to identify the critical issues which are most important for the Commonwealth to obtain what members are saying they want, which is a higher ambition and speed to deliver the things that we need to deliver in order to restore our ocean and to generate the sort of technological, scientific knowledge we need to do that which is right. That's particularly important for those who want climate justice, because a number of our states are deeply concerned that they may, with the sea level rise, lose their landmass. So the members are very clear that they want to have a declaration which expresses accurately the higher ambition that the Commonwealth has in relation to preserving the ocean. From the Caribbean, African, and the Pacific perspective, they know full well what this existential crisis feels like. They're touching it, they're tasting it, they're feeling it every day.
So, Madam Secretary General, what steps do you think can be taken to pave the way for the adoption of the declaration at the CHOGUM 2024?
Well, the first thing we need is for our ocean ministers from the 56 countries in the Commonwealth to agree what should go into that declaration, because the declaration will be the expression of their hopes, their aspirations, and indeed their commitment to action. What will then happen is there is a whole process which will be capable of being gone through. We have a meeting of all the senior officials before CHOGUM. We have a mission of the Council or the Committee of the Whole, which is all of the Commonwealth countries. The matter then goes to the foreign ministers, who have a meeting usually in the margins of the UN General Assembly, and then that preparation is ready for the communique, which will be discussed at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting itself, and hopefully will get endorsement. But what's so important about the fact that this meeting of all of our available ocean ministers here in the Cyprus first is we have a number of other meetings coming up. There's the meeting in Antigua, the SIDS meeting, the Small Island Developing States meeting. There's then the African Union meeting that will take place. Then there will be the Pacific Island Forum meeting. So this is a build-up, and it's really important that the higher ambitions, the aspirations of the ocean ministers who know the most about this subject, who are dedicated to working on this subject, that we get from them what their high ambition is, what they're going to commit to do. And what we know is when the Commonwealth commits to do something, it gets done. So if you look at the real change that has been brought about by the Blue Charter, we didn't just sign it, we had action groups, and those action groups have been working, and we know we have the empirical data which demonstrates that they have made a difference, and we are determined, all of us, that this declaration will make a difference too. It'll be a call to arms.
Mm. So, Madam Secretary General, before you go, let me put it this way, what are your expectations and major takeaways from this meeting?
Well, I think the most important takeaway is that we will hopefully have an agreed declaration, but we're also hoping that the ministers will commit to coming together for a working group on how we raise the finances that we need to deliver. We also are hoping to launch a toolkit in relation to gender and climate, because these issues are important.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. She spoke with me from the Cyprus capital, Nicosia. The Deputy Secretary of Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union says members of the group will not be intimidated or bullied into returning to work until their concerns are addressed. Dr. Denise Miskela says the organization is not deterred by threats by state institutions or individuals. His comments come after counties started issuing letters to fire doctors who have not returned to work. Citing a breach of their employment agreement contract, the counties fired the striking doctors. The doctors embarked on a strike, saying they have been waiting for 7 years for the government to implement an agreement to improve their working conditions. For the latest development and plans by the striking doctors following the dismissal of some of the physicians, I reached Dr. Denise Miskela.
You know, the counties can't issue threats all they want, but as long as they have nowhere to get doctors to treat Kenyans, then their exercise exists in futility. The country can issue all the threats they want, but until they address the issues you've raised, then they are issuing all those threats in futility. KMPDU and the doctors have put clear issues that they want addressed. Those issues can be addressed by anything except threats and victimization. So when they're done with the threats, they'll come back to the table and talk, and they love to do what we want. So instead of going through it round and round and making patients suffer, they better come early, we talk early and finish early, because as a union, we're not going to back down, because whatever we're asking for are reasonable things. Most of them don't even involve monetary issues. We were almost agreeing on everything. We only told them that Can we agree on timelines and who is responsible for doing what? And they refused. So you can see that they're just being naughty and trying to be cheeky by saying that they're going to do something, but they don't give you timelines, neither do they commit who is going to be responsible for doing it. So as a union, we are not going to be tricked into signing a charter of formula that cannot be executed, nor can it be followed up. Remember that the collective bargaining agreement that we were fighting about, or we are striking about, was signed by them, deposited in court by them, and they still dishonored it. So what, we're not naive enough to imagine that a mere return to work formula that is signed without such commitment will change their minds.
Some doctors are saying they have received the dismissal letters. I understand that you were even dismissed by a letter sent to you. How do you address some of these concerns of this dismissal of members of your organization?
We were alive to the fact that such prices will have to be paid. And we are alive to the fact that the price for liberty is eternal vigilance. And we know that they are going to do what they do best, issuing threats. And that's why the clarion call for our strike was that we have nothing to lose but the chains of fear, chains of selfishness, chains of self-doubt that keep on holding us back to back when we want to ask for what is rightfully ours. So they can fire us all. Personally, I've been fired, and I don't even feel I don't worry anymore, because I know that so long as I'm on the right side of history, everything, and we also know that when the strike will be ending, and because the strike must end someday, they will have to withdraw all those dismissal letters.
Well, the letters cite doctors' absence as a breach of their employment contract. Where do you go from here?
Yeah, of course, there was a court order that was against the whole victimization or firing of the doctor. So whatever they are doing is against the court order. But at this point, we're not going to allow the law to fight our battles. We're going to fight our battles using our unity, our solidarity, and our collective bargaining power, not through individual begging.
But I understand a court rule that the ongoing strike by medical doctors or by members of your organization is illegal.
That's why I've told you that we're not going to wait for the law to protect us, because we are dealing with employers that themselves are not keen on respecting the court orders. The CBA was a court order. We sued them. There was a court order. So the fact that they are not being willing to obey the court orders, our members are also very doubtful whether we need to really obey that court order. But more importantly, that even as they proceed and disobey the court orders around non-victimization, we are not going to wait for the courts. Neither will we hear as we going to report to the courts about them disobeying the court orders. We are purely going to use our collective bargaining power, our power to collectively ask for our rights, to fight back against such intransigence and belligerence.
Some of the medical professionals are complaining that they've not been paid between 6 to 9 months or more. But the Health Cabinet Secretary, Susan Nakumicha, said that the government has released about 3.5 billion shillings for payment of salary arrears from 2017 to June 24 to be paid over five financial years. Isn't this a step that could help resolve some of your major concerns?
That's a step, but when we went to strike, the main issue was not about the basic salary. The main issue was the intern doctor who had not been posted. And when the strike began, they posted them, but posted them at a third of their usual salaries. And so the stalemate which broke the talks was the issue around the interns, because we told them that we cannot go back to work until we address the issue around the interns. And they said they don't have money. So we told them that the 3.5 billion that you are claiming that you have availed to pay the basic salary arrears, use that money to pay the interns. We are willing as doctors to donate that money to pay the interns, and if they change, they can keep change.
Dr. Dennis Miskela is the Deputy Secretary of Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Uganda, the executive director of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative says the latest U.S. human rights report should be a wake-up call to the government to step up efforts to ensure the respect of human rights in the East African country. Attorney Livingston Sewanyana says the government should take deliberate actions, including the prosecution of those involved in abusing the rights of citizens. His comments follow a report by the U.S. on the state of human rights practices in Uganda. It highlighted challenges or weaknesses the country faces, including a lack of judicial independence. For more reaction, I reach Attorney Livingston Siwanyana in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The latest U.S. State Department report on human rights practices in Uganda chronicles and re-echoes so many of the challenges that have been arising and have been reported in various reports, both at the local and the international level. The report largely is a true reflection of the weaknesses that we still encounter and the growing backlash on democracy and human rights. However, the report, to a large extent, does not bring out the progress, some of the progress that has been made. And I think that needs to be addressed in future reports. For example, it talks about the increasing case backlog, the lack of independence of the judiciary, and of course the congestion in prisons. Indeed, that is true, but there are areas where there has been progress. For example, within the judiciary, there have been efforts to promote effective and expeditious disposal of cases through daily criminal hearings.
Some critics said that this should be a wake-up call on the government to ensure that individual police officers or security agents or other agents of the government do well to respect the right of Ugandan citizens. Others are saying, well, improvements have been made and the government is committed to doing the same. What's your take on that?
I think generally more needs to be done to curb a growing culture of impunity. I think the challenge here is impunity. Those perpetrators of abuse who are not prosecuted, those who commit acts of corruption, those who misuse their offices, and of course this emerging phenomenon of forced disappearances, all to a large extent paint a bad picture on Uganda's human rights record. So what we really need in this case is to address the culture of impunity. More needs to be done to punish perpetrators and also to curb acts of corruption. So that really is the essence of improving the country's human rights record.
Well, the State Minister for Foreign Affairs is on record to have said that human rights abuses documented by groups such as yours are not planned by the government, by errant police officers or security officers, and that should not be written as if it's state-sponsored. Your take?
I think overall the minister is emphasizing government's efforts to improve its human rights record by taking measures necessary to curb abuses. But of course, in their report, they also acknowledge the fact that there are individuals within state agencies who are misusing and abusing the law and taking advantage of vulnerable people. So all in all, it's true that to a large extent, there must be more and further commitment. But individuals, by their very nature, who abuse individual rights, if they are not prosecuted, they taint the government's the picture. So whether they are individuals, whether they are isolated incidents, the fact is everyone deserves respect and dignity.
Well, the State Minister, Okello Oryem, is of the view that Westerners should not come and teach Ugandans human rights and that the government has always shown commitment to respecting the right of citizens. Your take on that?
I think we should applaud him on that in the sense that he's committing government to take action to make improvements in its human rights record. But again, as we all know, we have a lot of geopolitics also involved. But overall, as a country, as a leadership, they must take responsibility, because that is the primary responsibility of every state, to ensure that the rights of its citizens are respected. So Western nations, when they come out, they are simply reminding the country in question that their obligations, and these obligations, are held by every country. And we all know that there's no country which has a perfect human rights record. And as such, we shouldn't quickly dismiss these reminders. We should simply acknowledge them and take deliberate action to make improvements.
Livingston Sewanyana is the executive director of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Mauritania, a member of the presidential team of the main opposition leader Biram Daoud Abeid says he offers the best alternative to resolving the country's challenges. Abeid, who is a prominent anti-slavery activist, came in second in the last presidential poll. Bakary Tandian denies media reports from political observers who say that incumbent President Mohamed Ould Ghazouani is the overwhelming favorite to win re-election. Both President Ghazouani and his main challenger Abeid have declared they will run in the coming June presidential contest. Bakary Tandian tells me that the opposition leader will win in spite of what he says is the president's power of incumbency.
Biram is, you know, the hope of Mauritanian people. He is the only viable alternative to the current system. He is running as a candidate of the opposition of the anti-system because we are not talking about, you know, replacing, you know, one person by another one, but we want a paradigm, you know, shift to change, you know, the system, the way, you know, the country is being led, to put an end to slavery, racial discrimination. We want diversity to be respected, equity to be guaranteed, as well as inclusion.
You said Biram is the only alternative to the
yes.
president, but statistics and analysts are telling me that incumbent President Ghazouani, who is the current chairman of the African Union, is the clear and obvious favorite in the polls.
I don't know exactly what polls they are referring to. Based on the images I shared with you, based on what happened in Nouakchott yesterday, he is in a very good position to win the elections if we have a fair and transparent elections. There is no doubt about it.
But the president's party, the El Insaf party, won a landslide victory in the last parliamentary elections, taking 107 of the 176 in the National Assembly. Isn't this a precursor to what is going to happen in the presidential election as well in June?
Yeah, well, you know, what happened during the legislative elections you are referring to, you know, this, you know, the system was completely screwed. To tell you, you know, the truth, the National Electoral Commission, which has, you know, the responsibility to ensure that there is transparent and fair elections, is completely, you know, on the side of the government. It was clear that the elections were manipulated and the results did not reflect the real will of Mauritanian people.
Why do you think so? Because the ruling party supporters deny this.
They can only, you know, support that point of view, because when you see, you know, the mobilization done by you know, the opposition, you know, particularly by President Biram Daoud and his collaborators, you know, there was no way the ruling party, you know, could win the number of members they got. You know, realistically, you know, that was not possible.
So what are your expectations in the coming elections? What are your expectations?
The expectation is that we are going to win. You know, but, you know, what is really, you know, interesting and new about this situation, you know, is that, you know, Biram is not the candidate of his party or his movement. So that's why he waited to build a coalition with different political parties. So he is the candidate of an alliance, a coalition, which bring together all anti-system, leaders. So this is really new. And because of that, people are very excited and they are confident that, they will make a difference during the elections.
Bakare Tandian is a member of the presidential team of the main opposition leader, Biram Dah Old Abeid. He spoke with me from New York. In Togo, the leader of the opposition Democratic Convention of African People's Party is calling for a majority win in parliament to, quote, overturn the country's new constitution approved by the legislature. Bridget Kafui Ajamagbo Johnson, a lawyer, human rights defender, and presidential candidate of the party, contends that parliamentarians who approved the new constitution did not have the legal authority to do so. Her comments came after the Democratic Convention of African Peoples, joined by other opposition and civil society groups, petitioned the regional ECOWAS court to challenge the new constitution. They seek to overturn the constitutional reforms. They say they are a power grab to ensure President Faure Gnassingbe stays in power for a long time. But supporters of the government reject the criticism, saying the new constitution significantly reduces the power of the president. Bridget Kafui Ajamagbo Johnson tells me that the opponents of the administration are determined to fight. She also adds that they have confidence in the ECOWAS court to help correct the wrongs in Togo.
We've submitted the issue to the ECOWAS court because what has been done is against the ECOWAS charter on good governance. And the rule is that a 6 months before election, nobody should make a reform unless there is a consent of the political parties. So in our case, the ruling party and especially the member of the parliament, you know that because opposition didn't go to the last legislative election in 2018, this parliament, let's say that it's composed only of the ruling party members and some friends that they've chosen, to be there as opposition.
But Mrs. Yes. Johnson, the question a lot of people are asking is, opposition groups came together with members of the ruling party in parliament to make this amendment, which makes their argument, they said, legitimate because the president allowed for consultations. The consultations were done, and that is why this was put in place. Why are you denying this effort?
Let me tell you that nobody has been consulted to have his say on what is going on. They just said that there would be a consultation when we started to say, no, we don't want this reform. But truly, they didn't talk to people, and Togolese people are against the reform. Togolese political parties, true opposition. I was explaining to you that what you have currently in the parliament cannot be called an opposition. They are not opposition parties. They are the ruling party friends.
On Wednesday, Togo's Constitutional Court rejected a petition by two opposition parties against the reform. Supporters of the ruling party are saying that your efforts to have this overturned in the West African Court or the ECOWAS Court will also fail. How do you respond to that?
What I will respond is that we have confidence in ECOWAS judges because they have already condemned the Togolese state for other issues. For example, they've condemned them and asked them to release political prisoners. The Togolese state refused to do it. We are confident that they will condemn them this time also.
Well, Mrs. Johnson, you just said that after the West African Court ordered political prisoners to be released, the Togolese government ignored it. So what happens if the ECOWAS condemns the constitutional reforms or the new constitution you have and the government ignores it? What happens?
Thank you very much for this question. What will happen is that we are currently explaining to Togolese people to give us the majority in the next parliament. Then, as soon as we'll be there, as soon as we'll get there, we will turn over this reform.
What makes you confident that the Togolese population will give you the mandate?
We are confident because we know that Togolese people are against this regime. And we are sure that this time we will be vigilant and will watch over our vote, and they will not be able to steal again this election.
Bridget Kafui Ajemagbo Johnson is the leader of the Opposition Democratic Convention of African People's Party. She spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lomé. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Sierra Leone, the Campaign for Human Rights and Development and other civil society groups are calling on the government to quickly resolve the ongoing power crisis. This after a majority in the capital, Freetown, and surrounding areas are expressing outrage over the lack of electricity. The crisis, local media reports, has forced the resignation of Energy Minister Kanje Sisi, the longest-serving energy minister since Sierra Leone returned to constitutional rule. Critics say it appears the government has not fully paid the full amount it owes to Car Powership, a Turkish floating ship which supplies electricity to Freetown. Abdul Fatoma is the chief executive director of the Campaign for Human Rights and Development. He tells me that residents in the capital are expressing disappointment over the electricity crisis.
Citizens across the capital city of Sierra Leone, Freetown, and also civil society organizations like us have been putting pressure on the government of Sierra Leone to live up to their obligation to provide the basic necessity for citizens. That includes electricity. The city have been in total darkness, you know, for more than 5 days, a few weeks ago. And so citizens were outraged about the neglect of providing electricity. And that even caused to the death of a child at one of the public hospitals. The Ministry of Health have to apologize, you know, for the power outrage contributing to the loss of life in government hospitals. And also offices and businesses are also having a lot of challenges, you know, to run their businesses. So citizens went on the social media calling on the government. That includes civil society.
Car Powership, which is one of the world's biggest floating power plant operators, with several African states relying on it for electricity, like Sierra Leone, says the government owes it Why is the finance ministry not paying this for power to be restored?
Much has not yet been disclosed to the public. I was, you know, on the national radio with the Director General of the Electricity Distribution Service in Sierra Leone, and he refused to disclose the figure after, you know, a day after the Chief Minister was on that very radio station. And he disclosed that is around $36 million. You know, the government of Sierra Leone owned the car power ship. But the latest development after our radio program, you know, 2 days ago, more pressure has been mounted on the government, and now the minister has resigned. And today, we have also been informed by the Ministry of Finance that out of the amount of money they own the car power ship, $17 million has been paid. And there is still ongoing negotiation to see how to settle the remainder, you know, and debt owned by the government of Australia to the car power ship. But what actually baffles citizens is this. We're using a prepaid meter. So citizens are saying, we paid our money and we don't get light. So why is it that? But the authorities are saying that, you know, there are a lot of lack of payment from state-owned institutions and corporations, and also citizens also engage in theft of electricity and also vandalizing, you know, their property. So these are the reasons why, you know, we're having these challenges. But it's ridiculous to accept, you know, such a lazy excuse.
Do you see this power crisis being resolved soon, even following the resignation of the minister?
I don't think so. Even though the Director General and other experts, you know, have been saying that if they have given the free will to operate, definitely they will be able to restore, you know, stable, reliable and clean energy within 6 months. But, you know, a lot of other experts are saying it's quite impossible because we have a faulty line. Before 2016, we were, 15% of our population was having access to electricity, and 2.5%, you know, from the rural area were having access to electricity. We're talking about, you know, 8 million population. So this is just a crisis, and we were losing, you know, up to 4% of the electricity we generate based on faulty distribution lines and also the networks that they have to transport this power. So we are losing more than what we are supposed to consume due to dilapidated equipment and network facility we have in the country.
Abdou Fatoma is the Chief Executive Director of the Campaign for Human Rights and Development. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. So-called green hydrogen has been touted as a renewable energy source that would help lower the carbon emissions which cause global warming. But what happens when corporate interest in hydrogen projects meet resistance from local communities? For VOA, Vitalio Angula has the details on one such conflict from Luderitz, Namibia.
Namibia's port authority, NAMPORT, has proposed a port expansion on Shark Island, a heritage site that is sacred to the indigenous Nama ethnic group of southern Namibia. The expansion is designed to facilitate green hydrogen production and export to Europe by a German energy company, Hyphen. However, some locals view the port expansion as a form of colonization, where African resources are extracted for the benefit of European markets. Germany once ruled Namibia, then known as German Southwest Africa, and in the early 1900s, German authorities ran a concentration camp on Shark Island, where around 3,000 locals were killed. Sima Lepert, a community activist and member of the Namba Leaders Association of Namibia, which has opened talks with the port authority, says the Nama consider the island as sacred ground.
Shark Island has got historical meaning to the Nama and the Ovaherero people, and it should have the same historical meaning and heritage meaning for the entire Namibia and for the world. This is where a genocide took place. This is where a genocide was executed. It was the first genocide of the 20th century, and for that, the site needs to be protected.
Hans Christian Manke of Namibia's Legal Assistance Center told VOA that Namibia's laws require developers to undertake environmental impact assessments in cooperation with local communities, who have the right to decline consent for any development they feel may violate their rights. He says the Nama have grounds to reject the port expansion on Shark Island.
Due to the increased capacity needs of the port in the wake of the green hydrogen development, then that Shark Island and the dignity of people are affected and linked to the drive by, among others, the German government to get cheaper, cleaner energy also from Namibia, yet the genocide talks and the reparation etc. have not yet been finalized, and we are already doing again harm potentially to the descendants of the victims by tampering further on with this historical site.
NAMPORT's executive for port engineering, Elysia Gelderblum, says the Nama Traditional Leaders Association has expressed opposition to port expansion, and the port authority is working on mitigating those concerns. He spoke with VOA at a conference for Namibia's emerging oil and gas industry being held in Luderitz.
We are employing experts, environmental experts, archaeologists, and marine archaeologists, and they are investigating this to determine exactly what impacts we might have. So we cannot answer yet whether we will have impacts. So the EIA, or the studies which we do, will identify if there are impacts, and if there are impacts, it will also indicate what mitigation measures can we employ to reduce such impacts.
Namibia has been identified as a potential green hydrogen source for its abundant sunlight and access to the sea, which developers say is crucial for the production of green hydrogen and its byproducts, which include ammonia and fertilizer. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Luderitz, Namibia.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Nuzele nezezi moliva na yokonye na pom Kamara na gaza yaza Udamebuname Enyi mudamebunamu kuchinyere kanjaga Udamebunam Oye mudamebunam Oliva na yoka mwebule bunamu kanjaga Oye mudamebunamu Ganjaga, ebu move a jump and we love. Are you moved the mebunamo? Other Lucy no num, other Naka pop noble L. I'm a mama. Even if you were the boo, the one that I see. Ah, even if you were the boo. Ebu kati munye na mu, ino waneke loleke. Oye muda mebu na mu, enye muda mebu na mu. Yeba wale ndika neche, ebi ifadi magesibia, ni ifadi mwananya yo. Oye mwala nyokudima,
ayika zubuka polai.
Oye mwala nyokudima, Ibanyokuna Lagos,
I got the Boka Polai.
Ibanyokuna Abuja,
I got the Boka Polai.
What was done in Nigeria?
I got the Boka Polai.
What would you got in Malaysia?
I got the Boka Polai.
Through South Africa, Noma,
I got the Boka Polai.
What was done in Nanibo?
I got the Boka Polai. Oliver
Bonapolo,
Oliver
Bonapolo,
Oliver
Bonapolo, bonye ndu obodo mu
oliva bonye kulo
oliva na yoka bonye kulo mmili
oliva bonye kulo
oliva na yoka bonye kulo mmili
oliva bonye kulo.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Tian Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, crabs teach their offspring to walk straight. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. Yeah.